questo scorre e gelido.
The manager came out. He did me the honor to take me under the arm and lead me aside.
"He's very low, very low," he said.
He considered it necessary to sigh, but neglected to be consistently sorrowful. "We have done all we could for him, haven't we? But there's no disguising the fact. Mr. Kurtz has done more harm than good to the company. He did not see the time was not ripe for vigorous action. Cautiously, that's my principle. We must be cautious yet. The district is closed to us for a time. Deplorable. Upon the whole, the trade will suffer. I don't deny there is a remarkable quantity of ivory, mostly fossil. We must save it at all events. But look how precarious the position is, and why? Because the method is unsound."
"Do you," said I, looking at the shore, "call it unsound method?"
"Without doubt," he exclaimed hotly. "Don't you?"
"No method at all," I murmured after a while.
"Exactly," he exulted. "I anticipated this. Shows a complete want of judgment. It is my duty to point it out in the proper quarter."
"Oh," said I, "that fellow, what's his name, the brickmaker, will make a readable report for you." He appeared confounded for a moment. It seemed to me I had never breathed an atmosphere so vile, and I turned mentally to Kurtz for relief, positively for relief.
"Nevertheless, I think Mr. Kurtz is a remarkable man," I said with emphasis. He started, dropped on me a cold, heavy glance, said very quietly, "He was," and turned his back on me. My hour of favour was over. I found myself lumped along with Mr. Kurtz as a partisan of methods for which the time was not ripe. I was unsound. Ah! But it was something to have at least a choice of nightmares. I had turned to the wilderness, really, not to Mr. Kurtz, who, I was ready to admit, was as good as buried. And for a moment it seemed to me as if I also were buried in a vast grave full of unspeakable secrets. I felt an intolerable weight oppressing my breast, the smell of the damp earth, the unseen presence of victorious corruption, the darkness of an impenetrable night. The Russian tapped me on the shoulder. I heard him mumbling and stammering something about brother seamen, couldn't conceal, knowledge of matters that would affect Mr. Kurt's reputation. I waited. For him, evidently, Mr. Kurtz was not in his grave. I suspect that for him Mr. Kurtz was one of the immortals. "Well," said I at last, "speak out. As it happens, I am Mr. Kurtz's friend, in a way." He stated with a good deal of formality that had we not been of the same profession, he would have kept the matter to himself without regard to consequences. He suspected there was an active ill will towards him on the part of these white men that—
"You're right," I said, remembering a certain conversation I had overheard. "The manager thinks you ought to be hanged."
He showed a concern at this intelligence, which amused me at first. "I had better get out of the way quietly," he said earnestly. "I can do no more for Kurtz now, and they would soon find some excuse. What's to stop them? There's a military post 300 miles from here."
"Well, upon my word," said I, "perhaps you had better go if you have any friends amongst the savages nearby."
"Plenty," he said. "They are simple people, and I want nothing, you know." He stood biting his lips. Then, "I don't want any harm to happen to these whites here, but of course I was thinking of Mr. Kurtz's reputation. But you are a brother seaman, and—"
"All right," said I, after a time. "Mr. Kurtz's reputation is safe with me." I did not know how truly I spoke.
He informed me, lowering his voice, that it was Kurtz who had ordered the attack to be made on the steamer. He hated sometimes the idea of being taken away, and then again— "But I don't understand these matters. I am a simple man. He thought it would scare you away, that you would give it up, thinking him dead. I could not stop him. Oh, I had an awful time of it this last month."
"Very well," I said. "He is all right now?"
"Yes," he muttered, not very convinced, apparently.
"Thanks," said I. "I shall keep my eyes open."
"But quiet, eh?" he urged anxiously. "It would be awful for his reputation if anybody here—" I promised a complete discretion with great gravity.
"I have a canoe and 3 blackfellows waiting not very far. I'm off. Could you give me a few Martini Henry cartridges?"
I could, and did, with proper secrecy.
He helped himself, with a wink at me, to a handful of my tobacco.
"Between sailors, you know. Good English tobacco."
At the door of the pilot house, he turned round.
"I say, haven't you a pair of shoes you could spare?"
He raised one leg.
"Look."
The soles were tied with knotted strings sandal-wise under his bare feet. I rooted out an old pair, at which he looked with admiration before tucking it under his left arm. One of his pockets, bright red, was bulging with cartridges. From the other, dark blue, peeped Towson's Inquiry, etc., etc. He seemed to think himself excellently well-equipped for a renewed encounter with the wilderness.
"Ah, I'll never, never meet such a man again. You ought to have heard him recite poetry. His own, too, it was, he told me. Poetry."
He rolled his eyes at the recollection of these delights.
"Oh, he enlarged my mind."
"Goodbye," said I. He shook hands and vanished in the night. Sometimes I ask myself whether I had ever really seen him, whether it was possible to meet such a phenomenon. When I woke up shortly after midnight, his warning came to my mind with its hint of danger that seemed, in the starred darkness, real enough to make me get up for the purpose of having a look round. On the hill a big fire burned, illuminating fitfully a crooked corner of the station house. One of the agents with a picket of a few of our blacks, armed for the purpose, was keeping guard over the ivory. But deep within the forest, red gleams that wavered, that seemed to sink and rise from the ground amongst confused columnar shapes of intense blackness, showed the exact position of the camp where Mr. Kurt's adorers were keeping their uneasy vigil. The monotonous beating of a big drum filled the air with muffled shocks and lingering vibration. A steady droning sound of many men chanting each to himself some weird incantation came out from the black, flat wall of the woods as the humming of bees comes out of a hive, and had a strange narcotic effect upon my half-awake sense. I believe I dozed off leaning over the rail till an abrupt burst of yells, an overwhelming outbreak of a pent-up and mysterious frenzy, woke me up in a bewildered wonder. It was cut short all at once, and the low droning went on with an effect of audible and soothing silence. I glanced casually into the little cabin. A light was burning within, but Mr. Kurtz was not there. I think I would have raised an outcry if I had believed my eyes, but I didn't believe them at first. The thing seemed so impossible. The fact is, I was completely unnerved by a sheer blank fright, pure abstract terror, unconnected with any distinct shape of physical danger. What made this emotion so overpowering was, how shall I define it, the moral shock I received, as if something altogether monstrous, intolerable to thought and odious to the soul, had been thrust upon me unexpectedly. This lasted, of course, the merest fraction of a second, and then the usual sense of commonplace, deadly danger, the possibility of a sudden onslaught and massacre, or something of the kind, which I saw impending, was positively welcome and composing. It pacified me, in fact, so much that I did not raise an alarm. There was an agent buttoned up inside an ulster and sleeping on a chair on deck within 3 feet of me. The yells had not awakened him. He snored very slightly. I left him to his slumbers and leapt ashore. I did not betray Mr. Kurtz. It was ordered I should never betray him. It was written I should be loyal to the nightmare of my choice. I was anxious to deal with this shadow by myself alone, and to this day I don't know why I was so jealous of sharing with anyone the peculiar blackness of that experience.